Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Thursday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on November 9, 2017. This is the second of a series of three talks on the Eightfold Path. This talk is on the virtuous factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
What we were talking about earlier while we're waiting for Olivia, it's an important thing to recognize, and it's also a difficult thing. I'm getting more comfortable with it, but it's a difficult thing to talk about because it's often seen as a self-referential ego self. Anything that is involved in I-making gets very defensive about anything that would challenge its views. It's just the nature of a self-referential ego self. So even doing something as simple and direct as pointing out the difference between one thing and another, in this case, between what the Buddha taught and what has developed, is taken as a denigration rather than just simply pointing out the differences. And of course, I can't point out the differences as someone who practices what the Buddha taught and it not be obvious that what I think is a superior teaching is what the Buddha taught, or I wouldn't teach it and practice it. But that's just the nature of it. You know, it's just the way things are. What is, to me, the kind of the essence of intolerance is to mindfully ignore those differences and say everything is really all the same. It all goes to the same point. We're all, you know, whatever that might be. I think that's more. That gives rise to more resistance and anger than simply the acknowledgement that, yes, there are hundreds, maybe thousands of religions, and they're all authentic in their own way. And many of them have different foundations, different ideas, but why don't we just let it be at that? But we can't, you know. There's this common... It's an aspect of a self-referential ego self to want to make everything into one thing and to reconcile everything to my point of view. And that's the most profound strategy that has been employed for thousands and thousands of years, to continue to ignore ignorance. To say, well, it's all one thing. And some of the most well-known modern Buddhist teachers say that that's exactly what we should be doing. We should treat all religions as one thing, and because they're all basically the same. The Buddha recognized that 2,600 years ago. In fact, that's really what is the whole foundation of what he taught, is to recognize the differences between all things and all ideas and abandon what continues eye-making, what can only contribute to more suffering. And we've created a world where most of this strategies that have been employed or to continue eye-making. And we had a kind of a good discussion about this on Tuesday night, too. All the social media stuff, and et cetera, et cetera. They're all a way of continuing to establish me in a way, you know, here, there, and everywhere, as the Buddha would say. But that's not tonight's talk. But it does relate to the Eightfold Path. And it points to the importance of even during the Buddha's time, he kept pointing people back to this path when they would get confused about what was going on in the world or other teachers. Use the path, he would say. Integrate the Eightfold Path, because then you can recognize wrong views. You can recognize views that are rooted in ignorance and that would only continue that ignorance. That's why he taught an Eightfold Path. So last week we started this series of three talks on right view and right intention, the wisdom factors of the path. The Buddha teaches right view in this way, to recognize when you're in wrong view and enter and remain in right view. To emphasize right view and the tenets of the Eightfold Path. And how do we know that? Well, that's the framework of the Eightfold Path, is to develop that right view. Initially, if we're experiencing... The Buddha described dukkha, and I use it in a very general way, as unsatisfactoriness. And so if we're having a life that has its underlying theme as being unsatisfactory or disappointing, or stressful, or to outright suffering, we know that there's an element of I-making in that. And so we need to change that view of taking things personally, that wrong view, rooted in ignorance, to a right view. And so again, the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path to do that. Right intention, then, is the intention to recognize the I-making in all things. And another way of saying that is related to the second noble truth, which is craving originates and clinging perpetuates suffering. So right intention, then, is the intention to recognize and abandon craving and clinging. And that leads directly to the virtuous factors. This is where what the Buddha taught has religious connotations, because most religions, not everyone, but most religions have moral and ethical tenets at their base. And so the Buddha taught that too, but not in a way that if we act within the framework of right speech, right action, and right livelihood, we'll get a reward in some kind of Buddhist heaven after we die. He taught morals and ethics simply as a practical way of living in the world, but also to recognize when we're not in accordance with these virtuous factors that we're engaging in eye-making. We're engaging in trying to manipulate the unsatisfactoriness of life to suit a personal view. Is that clear so far? Okay, so the Buddha's words, when the mind is inclined towards the Dhamma, meaning framed by the Eightfold Path, when the mind is inclined towards the Dhamma, the disciple of the noble ones, meaning the teachers of the Dhamma, gains a sense of the goal. They gain a sense of the Dhamma. We understand what we're doing. They gain joy to be connected with the Dhamma. And when we initially understand that we found a way to develop a life of lasting happiness, lasting peace and happiness, there's great joy in that, isn't there? And it's that joy that's important. It keeps us moving forward in the Dhamma. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. Rapture is kind of an archaic word, usually misunderstood. Rapture means being completely immersed in what's occurring. And in this case, it means being completely immersed in the Dhamma and being immersed in a way that is exhilarating and inspiring. Is that clear? And it's exhilarating and inspiring because we realize we found the truth. In one who is joyful, rapture arises. In one who is rapturous, the body grows calm. We know that we're doing what is completely appropriate in this moment and as our life occurs, as our life unfolds. One whose body is calmed, calm experience eases, meaning we're no longer reacting to what's occurring around us. In one at ease, the mind becomes concentrated. The purpose of meditation, now ultimately the purpose of the entire Dhamma. My words, right view initially is being mindful of the Four Noble Truths, beginning with the truth of stress or dukkha. Clinging, craving, desire, and aversion all cause unhappiness and stress. Right view then brings to mind the possibility of the cessation of stress. The Buddha could have nearly as accurately described the First Noble Truth saying that there is stress as saying there is distraction, because it is the ongoing preoccupation with dukkha, with stress, that distracts us from living our life as our life occurs. Our minds are thrown back to the past and into the future by chasing after what makes us happy and avoiding anything that might impact our happiness or security in this moment. And we've all had that experience. Understanding the cause of the distraction of stress and the possibility to end stress, right view develops mindfulness of the path leading to the cessation of stress. And that's the third noble truth also. The third noble truth is the experience of the cessation of stress, often written that it's possible to have that experience. Let's skip forward just a little bit. Mindfulness as presented in the Eightfold Path is developing mindfulness of all views of an impermanent ego personality. It is craving for objects, events, views, and ideas that support the establishment of an ego personality that initiates clinging. As understanding develops, it becomes clear that preoccupation with views attached to an ego self maintains stress. Once this process is recognized and craving and clinging diminish, preoccupation and distraction lessen. So I often describe awakening as gaining full human maturity. So the essence of being immature is clinging to things that we think we need to be happy. I want to always have my hand in that cookie jar. I always want to have access the things that I feel are going to satiate my desires. And I always want to feel like I'm in control of avoiding anything that might take away the cookie jar. It's the essence of immaturity, isn't it? And yet we carry that type of immaturity into our adult lives. We simply do it with more seemingly important objects, events, views, and ideas. And once we form attachments to ideas, then we'll go to extraordinary lengths, and usually in very and often immature ways, to defend those views. And I'll just use an example. Look at the world of politics today. It's just a real good example. But we do it in all aspects of our lives. Some people, they'll get in fights over their sports team, you know, silly things like that. That incident with, I shouldn't go there. We do this all the time with things that contradict the views that we're using to create an identity by. Other people that contradict those views or challenge those views directly, we often end up in arguments. And sometimes those arguments lead to battles, and sometimes those battles lead to wars. It's really the essence of all the problems in the world. That initial preoccupation with dukkha, that initial aspect of craving and clinging to objects, events, views, and ideas that we've created identities over, leads to all the stress in the world. Now remember, the Buddha taught that it's possible to bring that through cessation, and that's why he taught an Eightfold Path. Once this process is recognized, craving and clinging diminish, and preoccupation and distraction lessens. As distraction lessens, samadhi or non-distraction increases. Excuse me. Another word for samadhi or non-distraction is a well-concentrated mind. The practical benefits of the Eightfold Path begin to become apparent. And that's, I think every one of us has that experience. Just initially with practice, we start developing a well-concentrated mind, and almost immediately we're able to start seeing even rather subtle levels of eye-making. And in doing so, in that initial recognition, we're able to start developing strategies to abandon it. And that's, again, that's supported by the Eightfold Path. But every one of you have had that experience, haven't you? Recognizing eye-making in this moment?
Every day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It develops pretty quickly. It shouldn't be surprising, but it is often surprising how quickly that understanding develops just by having the right framework. It is the preoccupation with stress that creates the distraction that would continue wrong views. It is ignorance that gives rise to the belief that our ego personality is who we are and all that we are. Having this limited and wrong view of yourself gives rise to grasping, aversion, and delusion. That's kind of the I always need more mentality or compulsion. A self-referential ego self is never satisfied with no matter what it has acquired, no matter what it has squirreled away to create an ego identity by. This is me, this is who I am. Meaning it might be ever bigger houses or bigger cars or, you know, a bigger circle of friends. It could be anything. It could be, you know, when I first got into high school, I went from being a hippie to a jock to a nerd to a collegiate. And nobody knows what that is, but that was a person that dressed a certain way and acted a certain way. Because it was where my mind kept grasping after to establish myself. And I did that, I think, and most people do that in some ways, maybe not as quickly as I did, as I jumped from one identity to the next. But we all do that. And we form strong identities almost always by what and who we're associating with initially. So, the need of an ego personality to continue to define and maintain the ego self and its beliefs in all objects, views, and ideas is the essence of dukkha. Mindfulness of right, there's just ongoing stress in that. Mindfulness of right speech, right action, and right livelihood, the three virtuous factors of the Eightfold Path, shows clearly where attachments to an ego personality have formed. The ego self is consciousness influenced by physical senses and interpreting the sensory stimulation from the perspective of clinging conditioned mind. Kind of a long sentence, just to say that we create very subtle but powerful strategies to continue to ignore our own ignorance. And we do that by creating an ever-changing but seemingly continuous structured view of who we are in relation to the world. Is that clear? So this is why meditation alone cannot bring lasting peace and happiness. There's one of the biggest modern Buddhist schools is myself in trouble. It's rooted in the mind-only teachings called the Yogacara School, and it teaches basically that it's meditation alone that will bring awakening. And it's usually taught that if we meditate long enough, hard enough, with the right intensity, eventually our Buddha nature is going to kind of explode out of this intense effort. And I followed that for many, many years. And did many, many long meditation sessions. And sessions could be any length of day, usually 7 to 10 days or 14 hours of meditation every day. And it really is brutal. And the greatest thing about when that session ended is that it ended. I never really got, and that's not to say people don't get much out of that, but the Buddha never taught these long, overemphasized meditation practices. There's nowhere in the suttas where the Buddha said we should, where he mentions meditating for any length of time, whether it's a minute or 14 hours at a time. The Buddha's instructions on meditation are to go find the root of a tree or an empty hut, meaning find a quiet place. And then he gives simple instructions through the four foundations of mindfulness, and then through the understanding of the jhanas, what to experience during our meditation session. Lengthy meditation. Let's step that back a little bit. Meditation without the proper framework to recognize what's occurring in meditation. And I'll add, meditation that's used for any other purpose except to deepen concentration can and usually will only reinforce conditioned thinking, meaning wrong views or ignorant views. And often that type of meditation will use concepts to analyze, such as suffering or compassion, or intricate visualizations of the body or the breath, calling that mindfulness of the breath. And again, the Buddha never taught any of that. And those types of practices, without the framework of recognizing wrong views arising or ignorant views arising, will simply continue ignorance. There's no framework to recognize that. So the Buddha taught meditation to deepen concentration, and then he taught the broader framework of the Eightfold Path to recognize eye-making. And that's specifically where right speech, right action, and right livelihood are paramount. Many, many people, when they start developing the Eightfold Path, will specifically mention that right speech seems to be the beginning point where they're starting to recognize eye-making, what's coming out of their mouth. And it's not just what we're saying to other people, it's what we're saying to ourselves. In fact, that's really more important, to start recognizing the story that we're continually telling ourselves, because it's in that story that we're continuing eye-making within this, the Buddha described, this confining space of our ongoing conditioned thinking. Is that last little bit clear, Olivia? Good, okay. Without a framework grounded in right view, meditation can reinforce craving, clinging, and hurtful views arising from an ego self. I gotta tell a story. I tell this occasionally, but it's a good story because this is about a gentleman that gave me a call about 2 years ago now, maybe 18 months. And it clearly shows that developing a meditation practice without the framework of the Eightfold Path can lead to some pretty difficult moments. So I got a call from this gentleman who lived in Newtown. He said he heard of me somehow. I don't know. I've never actually met him. But I could hear the tension immediately in his voice. And he told me his story. He says, I'm 38 years old. I'm living the American dream. I got a beautiful house, a beautiful wife, beautiful kids, beautiful car, great job, and I feel like I have nothing in my life. And I could hear on the phone, he was almost on the verge of tears. He was so distraught over this. But as soon as he said, I feel like I got nothing in my life, and then he said, and I've been meditating for 20 years, I almost immediately knew where this was going to go. But I asked him, well, explain your meditation practice to me. And he says, well, I've been I've been this type of practitioner for all these years, and my meditation practice is to get quiet and just focus on nothing, and focus on the nothingness of all things. And I said, say that again. And he says, well, my meditation practice is about focusing on nothingness. And through the phone, I always say it this way too, through the phone I can almost hear the light bulb go off in his head, because he realized that for 20 years he was in meditation, focusing on nothingness, focusing on emptiness. And what was he experiencing in his life? Yeah. He was so caught up in that confined wrong view of nothingness that is often taught as the goal, that despite having a wonderful life, not that he should be attached to those things, but he couldn't even acknowledge what was going on in his life because his meditation practice has taken him that far from reality, living in this self-created void of nothingness. So that was the point. Lacking the understanding of right view, right intention, etc., he could not put those things in perspective, the good things that were happening. Maybe not even say the good things, but the skillful things that had developed in his life, because he couldn't even appreciate them in a realistic way. There's nothing wrong with having a great job and a great wife and a great house and great kids and great cars. Imagine having that and you can't even appreciate it. But that's where that type of meditation practice could take you, focusing on nothingness and emptiness.
What was he supposed to focus on?
Concentration? During meditation, yeah. Well, we had a few more conversations. He said he was coming to class, he never did, about how to develop meditation. And I sent him a copy of The Truth of Happiness. Anyway, yes, in meditation, we practice just being mindful of the breath. Whatever occurs, whatever is distracting us, come back to the sensation of breathing. And it really is just that. I think next week I'll be giving a talk on the Anapanasati Sutta, which gets into this a little bit deeper. But the Buddha never taught to manipulate the breath, in any way either. In other words, there's some mischaracterizations of the Satipatthana Sutta and the Anapanasati Sutta that take the Buddha's teaching and say, well, he taught to use a meditation practice just on being on deep breaths and long breaths and then shallow breaths and then to breathe into different parts of your body. The Buddha never taught any of those things. He taught to just use the sensation of breathing in your body, however it appears, to interrupt conditioned thinking or connecting one thought to the next. And every time we do that in meditation, we're deepening our concentration. And the reason why that's important is we can often then take the goal that, okay, I can only be mindful of the breath. And if I'm not mindful of the breath, it's not a good meditation session. It's not true. Every time we recognize we're caught up in our thinking, come back to the sensation of our breath, we're deepening concentration. And it's also why other kind of modern practices, such as if you have a pain somewhere in your body, to breathe into that pain. In meditation, in Shamatha Vipassana meditation, that's just another distraction. And it's not deepening your concentration. That's not to say that it might be a useful practice outside of meditation, if you happen to have that. But during meditation, for one thing, you can't breathe into any other part of your body except your lungs. We're not physically able to do that. So it's confusing to even think that you can do that. If you want to use meditation in a different way than is taught, that's fine. Simply recognize that it's not Shamatha Vipassana meditation within the proper framework. So there's some very effective strategies. Mindfulness-based stress reduction is one of them that uses the act of meditation in a different way. And that way has proven to be very effective in relieving pain. It's simply not what the Buddha taught. And so if you want to engage in that practice, do it separately from this, or you're not going to develop concentration. So I know that's not exactly what you're asking, but that's the whole answer. Meditation within this framework is for deepening concentration to support the refined mindfulness necessary to integrate all eight factors into our lives. That's how it works, and it's synergistic in that way. The Buddha's words on meditation practice: a true and effective Dhamma practice must incorporate these three trainings, the training in heightened virtue, the training in heightened concentration, and the training in heightened wisdom. All three factors. It's not just meditation. The other aspect of modern Mahayana Buddhism is the Bodhisattva vow, which is really a very compassionate vow, but often lacking concentration. Again, I was part of a, a lineage that never practiced meditation. It was a ritualistic and a worshipful practice rooted in compassion, rooted in the Bodhisattva vow. And that has led to a whole kind of modern engaged Buddhist movement where people are taking their social engagement as Buddhist practice and saying that's enough. And it's lacking wisdom. The Buddha referred to himself prior to his awakening as an unawakened Bodhisattva to describe himself as a human being who had great compassion for all other human beings, but lacking the wisdom and the concentration to actually be helpful in the world. And that's how he described that. So the Buddha taught that this Eightfold Path is a training in heightened virtue, heightened concentration, and heightened wisdom. All three of those. Right speech is a third factor of the Eightfold Path. By mindfully integrating right speech, it becomes clear how words are used to continue establishing a self that is prone to stress. Right speech is abstaining from lying or speaking truthfully, abstaining from divisive speech, including gossip, and speaking with compassion for all. It's abstaining from abusive speech, speaking with kindness and tolerance. Right speech is abstaining from idle chatter, meaning speaking only what is necessary and helpful in the moment. Wrong speech arises from clinging, craving, and aversion. It is often used to promote or defend the ego personality. Wrong speech can be very subtle at times. Gossip in particular is always hurtful and always arises from the desire to promote an ego personality. It is best to only speak of others when they are present. Idle chatter is used as much for distraction as for social interaction. The word kalyanamita means spiritual friendships. True friendships are friendships that are maintained without idle chatter. So I'll almost always get the comeback with this. You mean I can't just talk to my friends about... It's not really... That's kind of an extreme view, but it does mean to be careful about even your innocuous talk. And is it really just more idle chatter to continue distraction? And it really is the essence of true spiritual friendships when two people or a group of people can be together without having to keep the conversation going, isn't it? We're just... When on retreat, we experience that during our meals. And they're really a wonderful time, aren't they? And there's no community loss. In fact, it's probably increased in an interesting way by just being sitting together quietly. The need to always be talking in a externally referenced way is one thing that gives rise to gossip. Simply because we need an object to talk about with someone. And it's very supportive of an ego personality to talk about someone else to someone else in a way that puts them down in some way because it raises us both up, doesn't it? And it's always hurtful. It's always an aspect of ignorant thinking to even engage in that. But then even in a more worldly way of engaging in gossip, which is really just rhetoric to hurt or attack someone else's ideals. And that just leads to the suffering in the world too. A simple way of being mindful of right speech is to be mindful of what's coming out of my mouth, hurtful or helpful? Helpful. And if it's hurtful, to stop, and if it's helpful, to continue. If it's likely not to have any real benefit, meaning if you might have the most wonderful thing in the world to say, I don't talk about the Dhamma to people unless I know they're ready to hear it. If you think it's going to fall on deaf ears, keep your mouth shut. You know, we're not evangelists about anything. So that aspect of if it's likely to fall on deaf ears, it's a good time to practice restraint. And even if someone is engaging you in argument and seemingly looking for your input, the thought might be, well, perhaps I can help this person by engaging in argument. When if you just pause for a moment and think about that, there are times when you might be helpful. But oftentimes that's another time to practice restraint and practice right speech.
That's something that happens a lot in work.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean that there's times when you need to be given direction to someone. That's something else.
When you're dealing with... Right, but that's... something that I've been working on, and it's very helpful.
Yeah, it is. It keeps the peace in the workplace and also in your own mind. Often when we feel like we need to say something to correct someone's view, that's where we need to practice restraint. And that's different than just giving direction at work, meaning, you know, you need to rephrase this paragraph, or you need to tighten that nut a little, I mean, depending on what your job is. That's not the same thing. But when you feel like you need to correct someone's view, keep your mouth shut. Practice that's an essence of right speech. Because it's almost never, unless someone is asking your opinion. Unless someone, you know, says, I'm a big believer in Kagyu Tibetan Buddhism, but what do you think? Then I'll say something. But if they leave out that last part, but what do you think? I'll say, that's wonderful. Because it's not for me to convince other people. The same with any other religion or point of view. Imagine the peace in the world if we could just all do that. I'm going to say starting with one person. Don't want to go there, but I did anyway. I guess I did. As wisdom develops, an understanding that spoken words will actually be helpful to someone or to a situation will also show if they are necessary. Words that have no meaningful impact are part of idle chatter and can often prove divisive and will always be distracting to everyone. Right speech also pertains to what you are saying to yourself. This is probably, I should say, most importantly, and should be considered within the same guidelines. Is your self-talk truthful, helpful, kind, and compassionate? Are your thoughts a type of unnecessary idle chatter, which is really what a lot of our thoughts are? We just keep that monkey mind going. That's an aspect of idle chatter that's self-talk, just to keep that going. And that's an aspect of a self-referential ego self. That's where that monkey mind develops. Because that self-referential ego self must establish itself in every thought that arises. And one thought keeps following the next thought, and each thought is self-referential. And that's what makes meditation initially so difficult, because it feels like we're letting go, we're losing too much of ourselves. What's going to happen to me when I finally gain control of my mind? From the perspective of right view and the direction provided by right intention, right speech develops to very subtle levels. Once gross wrong speech is identified and mindfully abandoned, recognition of speech that may have seemed helpful and altruistic may now be seen to be manipulative and designed to elicit a particular response or reaffirm an ego's personality, meaning yours or others. And that's underlying a lot of modern engaged Buddhism. And it's almost always overlooked. It's there to be. It starts from a point of view that's seemingly altruistic, and it might be, you know, just to use an example, save the environment. But the underlying rhetoric is often manipulative and very harshly judgmental of other people, and that's never an aspect of right speech or right action. Being mindful of words expressed towards others will show the state of your well-being and understanding. Being mindful of self-talk will deepen understanding of craving and clinging and the further establishment of an ego self, the Buddha's words. Be mindful of wrong speech and enter and remain in right speech. Simple and direct guidance there, isn't it? How to develop right speech. Simply be mindful of wrong speech. And those guidelines are clear. If it's hurtful, it's wrong speech. If it's helpful, it's usually right speech. But if it's meant to manipulate a situation, probably best to keep your mouth shut. And if it has no meaningful purpose at all, it's always good to just sit quietly. Right action and right livelihood follow the same moral, ethical, and practical guidelines, and I'll just touch on those. Right action is abstaining from taking life, remaining harmless to all beings, abstaining from taking what is not freely given, taking only what is offered, abstaining from sexual misconduct and acting with generosity and kindness, abstaining from selfish acts, acting for the good of all. As with right speech, mindfulness of actions will show your attachments and what you most closely identify with. Karma means action, and it is the unfolding of intentional actions moderated by mindfulness that determines the direction and overall experience of your life. So often right speech is followed by right action. And when right speech and right action arise from right view and right intention, they're always pure. It never causes conflict in yourself and others. And it often works for the common good of all human beings. It's simply another good way of recognizing it. And the way you're living in the world is through that right speech and right action. And the Buddha's words on that, be mindful of wrong action and remain in right action. We know what it is. So all we have to do, literally, not to simplify, but all we have to do is to develop a way of being mindful of our thoughts and our deeds. And that's rooted in right concentration and then the framework of the Eightfold Path, that this is what I should be doing. I should be mindful of what's occurring. Right livelihood is abstaining from dishonesty and profiting from virtuous acts, abstaining from hurtful endeavors, contributing to the common good, abstaining from the sale of intoxicants, abstaining from the sale of weapons or harmful items. Right livelihood is remaining harmless when earning a living while contributing to the common good. While many of us do not have a direct choice for our livelihood, the product of our effort should fall within these guidelines. The Buddha's words, be mindful of wrong livelihood and enter and remain in right livelihood. A word about that, not killing and not engaging in the sale of weapons. The Buddha never taught that we should never kill animals. He taught that we should do it in a mindful way. And even the sale of weapons, there's an underlying, the context needs to be understood. If you know that you're selling something that will likely be used to hurt another human being, that's what we're talking about. There are entire societies on this planet that if they didn't kill animals, they'd simply perish. They would starve to death. They require eating animals to survive. These are mostly in northern climates, but there's millions of people that live that way. And so conversely, when they need a gun to kill a caribou in order to feed their family, it's good that there's somebody around that's selling guns. Selling assault rifles on a corner of in Times Square is obviously wrong livelihood, isn't it? Because you, as a human being, know what that gun is likely going to be used. So, I don't want to get into the whole gun control debate, but to make blanket statements one way or another is an extreme view and does not work in the world. The Buddha taught an eightfold path to avoid those extreme views of anything that would say we, you know, killing any animal at any time is always wrong, or the sale of a gun is always wrong, because we can see that other people would suffer because of that. And even the Buddha, I don't want to get into that political part, the Buddha never counseled, he counseled kings who were responsible for armies and republics. There was a lot of tribal republics too around during the Buddha's time. And I never read anything where the Buddha said, get rid of all your arms and allow yourselves to be slaughtered. What he acknowledged was that they lived in a violent time, just like ours. What he counseled is when you vanquish the person you're in battle with, treat them with kindness, treat them with equanimity. But he also understood that it was foolish to say that we all just should live in harmony, because it wasn't likely to happen yet. It wasn't true during the Buddhist time. It's unfortunately not true 2,600 years later. And just to touch on that, there's quite a few stories in the Pali Canon where the new monks and maybe nuns, and it's never mentioned that a woman did this, a nun, would come back from their alms rounds. I mean, they go into town to get a bowl of food so they could live for the day. And the monks would get a hold of the Buddha and say, oh, this person tried to offer me a little piece of fish and I wouldn't take it. And the Buddha always chastised them for a lot of reasons. One is that we're disrespectful to the person that's trying to feed you, aren't they? And then pointing out the arrogance, the eye-making, and thinking that they've created an ideology about the teaching to not kill people and not kill things. It's just foolish. We don't lose the ability to think critically. In fact, we gain the ability to think critically. I was always confused about the whole idea of guns and vegetarianism and all that stuff. I never quite could. The many, many years that I was a vegan and a vegetarian, doing it from an ideology didn't seem quite right. for health reasons, if you think that it's healthier to eat just vegetables, that's fine. But to do it for an ideology didn't sit right with me. And it wasn't until I really understood what the Buddha was teaching that that my misgivings about it made sense. I was just seeing things from a very confused point of view. As virtue is developed, an understanding of the importance of bringing wisdom to compassionate thoughts, words, and deeds develops. In the Ratana Sutta, the Discourse on the Three Jewels, the Buddha and his attending monks first addressed the physical and emotional needs of a town that had been devastated by natural occurrences and disease. They then presented the Dhamma in a way that would have meaning. In other words, our physical needs, and the Buddha identified these as they're simple needs, but we all have the need for food, shelter, clothing, and medicine. Every human being has that. We should attend to that mindfully, but we don't have to overemphasize that. And then when those needs are met, to spend some time in, we'll get to this next week, but to spend some time in right effort, meaning the effort put in on our meditation cushions to deepen our concentration, and the effort, like we're doing here tonight, to deepen our understanding of how to integrate the Eightfold Path into our life. Excuse me. So this week we're looking at how important it is to be mindful of right speech, right action, and right livelihood as a way of recognizing self-referential views, as a way of recognizing eye-making when we're engaged in the unskillful aspects of speech, action, and livelihood, and to simply recognize it and abandon that type of thoughts, that type of behavior, that type of livelihood. We don't have to analyze it. We simply recognize it, come back to right speech, come back to right action, come back to right livelihood. So that's the virtuous factors. We'll conclude next week with right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Thank you. So any questions about this before we just go around the room? No? Tim, good to see you.
And you, John? Yeah, Kevin? See you? I'm struggling with meditation. Not just because the one thing my concern was this time of year is very a lot of distractions, and I'm fortunate to go to the sanghas because it strengthens my practice where I can at least recognize the distractions and they don't grab me and create anxiety and pain and discomfort and depression and all those things. Yeah. So I can recognize it, and I said this to you a couple classes ago before, I feel like I'm in this wall, this shield, when I'm meditating, and these distractions just get in, and get in, and when they do get in, I really need to stop what I'm doing and meditate and just think about what's going on. And I'm grateful that I have these tools and that I'm learning these tools. When I hear sutras like this and John's teachings, it reinforces these things for me. I'm very grateful for it. Thursday's sanghas are very interesting to me because they're small. And it's a different energy that I feel more comfortable in. And these teachings are so full of information. There's so many things. I almost wish that they were chopped up into 4 or 5 segments because they're so... Which is why I'm grateful that you repeat them periodically. One thing I keep coming back to when I hear the Eightfold Path and I hear it talk about the virtues and the right livelihood and the right speech and right action, I keep thinking of expectations. And I was not confused about that, but I often wonder about what importance the expectation of the daily, of what I'm doing is. What is my expectation of what's going on? Is it shrouded in some kind of eye-making, in some kind of me being the best at what I can do? whatever that may be. And it can get confusing. It can get really confusing. With that, I think about things like my hobbies or my work or my family, and it's my nature to, and not in a negative way, to do things really well, whatever that may be. And I often get confused about, is that a right intention? Is that something that is hurting me ultimately? I don't feel that way, because I will say, and I'll keep it short, sorry for the long thing, that through meditation and this concentration and me recognizing these things, all the things that I that bring joy to my life, my family, my work, my hobbies, my friends, living, mean much more to me. So I have a feeling that my intentions and my expectations are okay. They're not rooted in some kind of ignorant, ego-boosting, make I want to be better because I want people to recognize me type of thing. I feel that it's something that I just want. I just enjoy the quality of things around me. And but it's something I'm kind of working through. I don't know why I wanted to share that today. This sutta kind of reminded me of that, this teaching, because of intention and right action and all those things. So thank you for bearing with me on that.
No, thank you for sharing. You touched on so many things, Tim. That confusion around expectations. Should I have expectations? And even the subtle questioning when you're in an expectation, even around the Dhammas. Should I expect to be awakened? When it leads to an uneasy or agitated mind, meaning a mind that's even more confusion, it's because there's I-making in it. Mm-hmm. But, and this is where I mentioned the Ratana Sutta, we're taking refuge in the Buddha, meaning that a human being actually figured this out, and that human taking refuge in his Dhamma, he left his teachings, and what you just described, that you have a Sangha in which to reinforce your meditation practice in the whole Dhamma. That brings an ease, or at least it can bring an ease and a calm to your Dhamma practice, because you know you're doing what you can do. Mm-hmm. And where we have a right to under, not a right, it's the wrong word to use. We can expect awakening because we're doing the things that lead to awakening. It's the same as I can expect that I'm going to get home tonight because I'm going to do the things necessary to get me home. That is an understanding of taking true refuge. So where you get caught is maybe wanting it too quick, or even judging yourself, and this is one of the hindrances, doubt, judging it, are you doing it correctly? Because that can lead to even deeper confusion and say, and get to a mind state where I just can't even figure it out, I'm not going to do it anymore. Instead of integrating the Eightfold Path just like you're doing and seeing and recognizing the benefits of the practice almost immediately in a very short while, and then continuing to use that as the framework. You started with talking about meditation recently hasn't been all that great because of the distractions, but it's reinforced by the Sangha. Mm-hmm. Again, that's part of taking refuge. And we are so incredibly fortunate to have what's developed here in Frenchtown, because we can do that. There is a place of true refuge that way, right here, that reinforces our meditation practice. In the 8 years or so that I've been teaching, there's a lot of people have come through here. Not everyone has continued. And that's just the way it is. But I talk to some of those that haven't continued. Some of them come back after a while. In fact, many of them come back. It's more common for people to come for a while and leave and then come back and leave. They almost always say that it's when they lost coming to the Sangha that their practice just fell apart. It's very, very difficult to continue a Dhamma practice without the support of the three refuges, meaning that last one, the Sangha. I'll leave it at there. I think I commented on.
You did, yeah,
but
you did.
But what you brought out was so important because it's pointing to developing the entire Eightfold Path. There were times early in my practice where I need to awaken now. I can't wait. And of course, it wasn't time. But when I finally understood what the Buddha taught and how he taught it, it sounds like a cliche, a great peace came over me. A great peace came over me because I understood that the only thing I could ever do is to do my best and develop the Eightfold Path. That thought changed my meditation practice from always, even an underlying need to acquire something or have a wonderful meditation session, to just realizing that every time I sit, I'm deepening my concentration. And I could immediately apply that concentration to my understanding of the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path. And in that way, the framework of the Eightfold Path itself, the entire framework, brings such peace, but a subtle, powerful energy to life as life unfolds, too. Because I know that I'm living the most effective life I can live. And again, it's not what's going on outside anymore. And you're pointing to that by what you're talking about, so thank you. Olivia, good to see you tonight. How are you?
Good to see you. Good, thanks.
Good.
Single mom. So in my head I thought, once I get my own place and once I'm there with my daughter, if I'm not this family unit of three, that there's no way I can ever be happy. And not to say that I don't eventually hope for that, but in the meantime, if I don't have that, I feel like if I can't manage to be peaceful and have some kind of contentment and happiness in the scenario of, say, just me and my daughter on the holiday there without like the family unit thing, then I'm seeing some kind of there's a false truth there in some sense. So of course, contemplating. I think that I saw some kind of a truth because I realized, well, rather than say this holiday being about just about that, maybe I could, make something positive out of it and, to a soup kitchen and, you know, help some other people, you know what I mean? Rather than sitting and feeling sorry about my situation, you know, to do whatever I can to do something new this year, like help a few people, like give myself a little list, you know? So I'm like giving positivity out there rather than, and that also, it also made me think about that just because my brother saw on the internet about some little boy who has cancer and he wants a bunch of Christmas cards. And he said he felt like he needed to send him one, you know? So I guess just certain things like that, I feel like I might have seen some kind of a truth that I hadn't seen all along, but for some reason, even though I'm supposed to be, I mean, I've been concentrating on my breath while I'm doing the meditation. I know that's what I'm supposed to be doing, but just through like the things that you were saying and stuff, somehow I came up with that, and I feel like it's a good thing.
I think it's a good thing. Sounds good to me. Anything you can do that is helpful towards others is a way of diminishing eye making. You know, it's just, it's the essence of it. And before I forget, please come to our Donna dinner and bring your daughter and bring the whole family.
Yeah,
it's just a wonderful time. What you're describing, Olivia, that the notion that there has to be this three-unit family in order for it to be, for us, for all of us to be happy, is simply a view, isn't it? And it's
it
a
is.
View that you could be attached to, unless you have a way of recognizing that it is just that. It's just a view. And the Buddha described that view as like foam on the ocean. There's nothing to it, even though it seems, it could seem the most important thing in your life, that I can't be happy unless there's a three-unit family. Rather than recognizing that all things are impermanent, and you have had that experience. That doesn't mean that that understanding impermanence is not without some pain. But understanding that all things are impermanent, and what's occurring right now in Olivia's life is what's most important, meaning to be accepting of what's occurring and simply to be present with life as life unfolds. You're showing a great understanding in a very quick way of developing the Dhamma, to see things and stop, to recognize views that are rooted in wrong views, meaning rooted in ignorance of the way things are. Recognize that and simply abandon them. And that can lead to, you know, forget the holiday season, it can lead to a life of great meaning and peace and happiness, no matter what's occurring, no matter what time of the year it is. So thank you for bringing that up. And then as you continue to integrate the entire Eightfold Path, that insight that you're gaining will only increase. It's just the way it works. So glad you're here tonight.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. Kevin, good to see you. How are you?
Well, thanks. These are very heavy topics, and there's so much depth to it, and so many different directions that my mind goes in as we talk about it.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, even from what you guys are saying, and what I think too a lot is, I think a lot of stuff comes up from negative self-talk. So it's that maybe unskillful speech to ourselves about ourselves. You have to be careful about it in a way, because, I mean, there are the hindrances that the Buddha talks about. So, and you can sort of categorize your bad self-talk as it is there, that hindrance. But then sometimes, you know I will get carried away with it and think, gosh, I'm really bad here, you know, because I have all these hindrances. But I think in deepening concentration, we can recognize the hindrances and recognize that self-talk and bring yourself back to breathing, keeping your concentration, and then it just allows the rest of the Eightfold Path to flower. So that's where we're headed. And I think you are, and I think we all are.
Yeah. Thank you, Kevin. That is, as you said, the hindrances are simply to be recognized. And when we have developed the Eightfold Path, we simply do recognize them as hindrances. We don't take it personally. We don't think we're doing something wrong. They're just common hindrances that we all have. Recognize it. Put it aside. When we start judging ourselves about being doubtful or needing more sensory input or being stuck in ill will, we're just reinforcing that behavior, aren't we? But as Kevin said, you simply recognize it and come back to the framework of the Eightfold Path. That's where that... I keep talking about the power of having, of integrating the Eightfold Path. That's really what it is. It's the power to live a meaningful and peaceful life without the need for anything to be any different than it is. It's remarkable. Bad this guy figured it out 2,600 years ago, and his teachings are still here. Still in this room. So, any other questions or comments before we finish? A week from Tuesday is Adana dinner. And I hope you're all there and bring your family, etc. There's info on crossrivermeditation.com. If you can bring a dish to share or maybe a practical gift, that would be great. We can always use help cleaning up at the end of the night. It's really on the website. I'm asking for volunteers, but it's really just that. At the end of the night, we can just help cleaning up, and everybody does anyway. So there's not much else to do. Love and Oven does such a great job anyway. We'll finish with metta, as we always do. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your body, and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.